Запад вечно боялся российской агрессии.
Одна проблема — Владимир Путин, а другая проблема —
отношения между Россией и Западом стали основной.
Америка и Запад не любят и ненавидят Россию.
Штаты могут существенно сократить свою зону влияния.
Если вместе с Западом или в изоляции.
Если драка неизбежна, бить надо первым.
Is the West up to a challenge of a resurgent Russia? How are Russia's military interventions in Ukraine and Syria related? These are just a couple of the issues being addressed at the Warsaw Security Forum, an annual gathering of experts and policymakers in the Polish capital. And this year, the Power Vertical is there. Hello from the Warsaw Security Forum, and welcome to a special edition of the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog at RFEL. Joining me here in the charming and historic city is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
Well, your panel's already met, Mark, so it was the first one, and quite frankly, I thought the best one so far. And it was a pretty fascinating discussion. The title of the panel was The Rise of the West in a Post-Western World. It included former Lithuanian President Landsbergis, former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili, the current governor of Odessa Oblast, and others. What was your takeaway from that panel?
Well, obviously, the first most striking takeaway is that you own a jacket, Ryan. But moving on from that, I think it spoke to an interesting sort of wider issue, which is whether or not we should be worried or whether or not we should be riding out the storm. Informing a lot of the Western discussion at the moment is, even when Russia isn't actually mentioned, the question of whether or not basically Russia is winning on some levels. And it seems perverse and bizarre. Russia, this impoverished country, whose indeed has got economy getting worse and worse, but nonetheless, could it be winning against the West? And I think what this speaks to actually is a lack of confidence, a lack of certainty. The world has changed, and we're not quite sure how it's changed. And I think that's causing a lot of introspection.
Yeah, no, I thought I'll give you some of my takeaways in here, and it's basically along the lines of what you're talking about. Something Saakashvili said that really stuck with me. He recalled the 1970s. And he said, remember the 1970s, remember when the West was divided, post-Vietnam, the transatlantic relationship not in the best of shape, the West looks weak and divided, the Soviet Union looks resurgent. And we all know where that ended up just a decade later. You made a point that I thought was along these same lines, was that Western liberalism is creatively destructive, I think is the elegant phrase you used. And you say that it's constantly reinventing itself and in the process, constantly becoming stronger. But the other side of that coin is it goes through these periodic periods of self-doubt, self-questioning, and ultimately catharsis, but which is something Russia's never gone through, but that's another issue entirely. And in these periods, Moscow, and we're in one now, the U.S. went through its post-Iraq War funk. Europe is going through its funk right now. Moscow may be weak, but it's very skilled at exploiting the West's self-doubt. I want to quote you back to yourself. Putin is holding up a mirror to the West's weaknesses, but he can only be as successful as we allow him to be. You want to expand on that?
Yes, and let me just first of all start by going back to what you're saying about the 1970s, because I also agree it was actually a very good parallel. And it's worth noting that wasn't even the only one. I mean, one could go back to the 1930s, one could look at all kinds of times where there's been this great sort of existential debate. And it's almost actually a Marxist process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, mm-hmm. and something new coming out. But exactly, the Western liberal order will evolve and will change. But as you said, at the moment, actually in this metamorphic moment, it does mean that we are vulnerable, not only to self-doubt, but also because there is a disconnect between how our structures and our institutions and how our whole concept of ourselves does not connect with the real world. A real world that is being shaped by all kinds of other forces, from the globalization of business and money to the rise of new powers such as China. And it's in that context precisely that Putin gets his opportunities. That Putin can take the pretty limited forces and resources at his disposal and apply them strategically at the key points. That because there is a crisis of legitimacy, for example, within the West, a sense amongst a significant proportion of the population that they are basically being lied to and exploited by some kind of generic elite. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're much more willing to tune in to RT, which purports to tell them the real story behind what's going on. The fact that we have this incredibly fungible flow of money around mm-hmm. these days, which means it's quite easy for the Russians to route money through half a dozen different shell corporations, front companies and offshore tax havens, and then move it in and perhaps buy up strategic industries or use that to support disruptive political movements without it being easy for us to actually finger and say, look, that is Moscow gold coming in. So I think this is it. It's actually that precisely because we're at this moment of change, and it's not going to be an instant moment of change, but it's a period of change, a period in which actually a lot of old certainties don't really apply, that it gives Putin this opportunity.
Are we more vulnerable now than we were in the 70s? When you grew up in the 70s just as I did, and we remember it as kids, but you can't help but remember the self-doubt. This is why Saakashvili's comment really resonated with me, because I remember that. And I remember what came after. But one of the things that's different is that at that time, oil prices were very high. And historically, Russia has been more aggressive in times of high oil prices for obvious reasons. They have more money in the coffers. What's different now? Putin's doing this in a period of low oil prices, which is paradoxical, which would suggest we were more vulnerable then than we are now, no?
I'm not sure if you can draw direct comparisons, because simply having money doesn't necessarily mean you get to spend it right. I mean, the fascinating thing was, for example, in the 70s, the extraordinary level of concern there was about the Soviet military. And it's only afterwards that we realise how many sort of deep institutional and structural flaws there were within that military, for example. I think it is very hard to draw comparisons. But in a way, I think that what we're looking at now, this is not apparently directly connected to oil price, but this is actually the logical corollary of the decisions that were made by Putin when oil prices were buoyant. Mm. It's precisely because he built this model of a state in which, assuming that there not only was there lots of money today, but there will continue to be lots of money tomorrow and the day after, you could spend money on basically elevating the quality of life of your average Russian to keep them happy. And he did that. You can spend money on buying tanks and guns and bombs and all the shiny militaria, and he did that. And you can spend money keeping the elite happy by allowing them to steal with impunity, mm-hmm. and he did that. It's now, because the money isn't there, that you actually have these really quite deep-seated structural political challenges facing Putin, that I think it's one of the reasons why he is so aggressive. It's because it is an aggression that is born out of on some level or other, an appreciation of weakness. Mm. That actually he cannot stand still. If he's not pushing, then he's losing. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I think this is a hangover from an oil-fueled euphoria. Mm.
Now, you mentioned in the 70s how we in the West overestimated the Soviet military. Now we're suddenly seeing a lot of analyses of the Russian military now, how it is back, it's resurgent, it's got all these shiny new toys, and it's not afraid to use them. Are we doing this again?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, again, look, human beings are great engines of overcompensation. we tend to swing gaily from one extreme to another rather than really learning our lessons. And I think that's what we're doing. We are looking at exactly the kind of indices that the Russians would like us to look at. How many tanks there are, that kind of thing. The Soviets always had far, far more tanks than mm-hmm. the West. But the point is, actually, the arithmetic is not how many tanks do you have, but how many anti-tank missiles have you got for the other person's tanks? I mean, that's just one very specific example.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Their nuclear arsenal had more megatonnage, but that was because their bombs were bigger because they were less accurate. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, exactly. And even then, we would never know not only how accurate, but actually how many of them would really have launched. Thank God we never got to find out. But this was always the issue that the Soviets made up for with mass, what they lacked in finesse and expertise and just quality. And I think that's, to an extent, what we're getting now. Now, in fairness, one could say, well, you don't need to be the best. You just need to be good enough. And good enough is certainly good enough for doing certain things. It's fine for chewing through the Ukrainian military as it's currently constituted. It's fine.
Although it didn't do that great on that.
Well, yeah, but in fairness, they did well enough. Again, that's the level. That's all they have to do, is well enough. They won the Georgian War far more problematically than they'd expected, but they still won it. That's well and good. And if they want to tangle next time with Kazakhstan or whatever, they're good enough for that. But if we're talking about either tangling directly with NATO, which I don't believe for a minute is going to happen, then I think actually that's where the qualitative technological edge really will show itself. And, you know, the Iraqis showed what happens when actually a relatively small technological edge is applied properly. You know, the Iraqi military was a pretty good military. It was well-trained, it was disciplined, and it had near enough the most modern Soviet-Russian kit available. And it was just chewed away mercilessly by the most technologically advanced forces in the world. But so I think NATO is not going to be a thing. And so the other option is, well, what about intervention? What about the Syrians of this world? And even then, we come up against the fact that the Russians have historically been teeth rather than tail. They're fine about actually sort of having things that, go bang. But the supplies, the logistics, the training, all that's needed to use that effectively is lacking. And they don't have the logistical capacity to deploy much force farther. They couldn't put a division into Syria, even if they wanted to.
How would you assess the reforms? I mean, it's ironic. It's Serdyukov's reforms that have basically made what's happening right now possible. And he was kicked out for a number of reasons. Now he's back in another capacity. But how would you assess where is the Russian military now, though? It's not the laughingstock it was in the 90s. But it's not this powerful big red machine it's being played up to be by some analysts.
I mean, it is reforming, but reforming is very much something that's in process. Even the Russians' own rearmament plans really looked to 2020 as the point when they were going to overhaul everything and so forth. That has now been quietly pushed back precisely because of economic reasons, and I think precisely until there is some kind of really quite sustained economic recovery, I'm not just talking about, you know, a percentile point, but something more than that, it's going to continue to slide. My view has historically been that actually, if you look at where the Russian military is now, it's about a third reformed. There's about a sort of, roughly speaking, a third of the army, largely in the more elite units, the paratroopers, the naval infantry, the Spetsnaz special forces, some of the ground troops, have been brought up to pretty good standards. Not absolute world-beating. They're not the equivalent of American or British or even German troops. But, I mean, say Italian, which is not bad, despite the opprobrium that tends to surround the Italian military. You know, it is a pretty good second team advanced military. So that's maybe a third. In part, the cost of doing that has meant that the other two-thirds have suffered and been largely unreformed. And it also means that there's an element of cannibalisation. The best young officers, they know they want to get into the good units rather than the bad, which means you have a disproportionate number of bad officers in the others. You still have high levels of dedovshchina, this very brutal hazing, bullying system. You still have high levels of crime, corruption, embezzlement, drunkenness, all these other pathologies of the Russian military. So in some ways, while the Russian military is about just over 700,000 strong these days, really, if you're looking at the guys, you know, I'm not saying your average Russian conscript won't be fine if someday an enemy rolled across the border. They would defend the motherland.
Right.
But if we're talking about the kind of more careful, finesse-oriented operations, which even Ukraine involve a certain amount of finesse, and they're not just some carpet bomb everything in sight, really, you're talking about at most a couple of 100,000, in my opinion.
From hard power to soft power, one of the other points that Saakashvili made on the panel that stuck with me, because it's a point I've made numerous times as well, is that Russia has no real soft power to speak of. It has no model that anybody wants to imitate. But what it does is it's created its own form of soft power. Oligarchs, corruption, organized crime, etc. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and we're back to this point of Putin's strengths are the ones that we allow him. Precisely. I mean, the way the Russians operate is through these unreformed or post-reformed forces that operate in the shadows or at the extreme end of the sort of, shall I say, the spectrum of morality and legality. And it gives him a certain degree of traction in times he otherwise wouldn't have it. But we also have to think, but what does this actually do for Russia and for Russia's image? I mean, I think this is it. It's actually, it's a short-termist model.
Well, they've weaponized crime, basically.
They have weaponized crime, absolutely. And in some cases, that's useful. It helps their intelligence gathering. It helps a certain amount of sort of moving money and such like. But it also means that precisely Russia is regarded as a haven of criminality. They have clearly thrown in their lot with a whole variety of dubious oligarchs in Ukraine, but also elsewhere, we have to say. But in the process, they are basically aligning themselves with the people whom everybody loves to hate. I think the thing is, the interesting thing is actually they acquire this, shall we say, this shadow power, which is a weaponizable force.
That's a good word for it.
But actually, it almost means that their soft power starts going into the negatives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the opposite of actually having soft power is. They actually have soft.
Well, I think you hit it there. Shadow power is a.
Well, this is it. But you might say, but one eats the other.
Mm.
And actually, again, it's astonishing the extent to which. Russia is by no means the most authoritarian, the most brutal, the most ugly regime in the world. By no means.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's fascinating when you hear, come to something like this, and you hear the conversations, and you would almost think that precisely Russia is sort of some.
Well, because we're talking about European security here, and we're holding them up to a higher bar mm-hmm. than we would hold something that can make no claim to being a European power.
Sure, right? Sure. So it's but I think, again, but you know, even here, and obviously, you know, everyone here is steeped in international affairs. They're not totally myopic in their perspectives. But I think this is it. I mean, Russia is now acquiring for itself a reputation which is actually far worse than it really is, mm-hmm. precisely because it has decided to throw in its lot.
But I think it's cultivated that reputation almost under Putin. It's cultivated. They like being the bad boys, no?
They like being the bad boys, I believe, in the sense of the unpredictable ones, and also the tough guys rather than the bad boys. I mean, they love the coverage in the West about their planes blasting the hell out of things in Syria.
Right.
And you see this extraordinary feedback loop whereby, you know, Western accounts get reported and rerun in Russian accounts, right. and so the merry-go-round continues. So they enjoy being the tough guys. But actually, I think there is a point where they genuinely, I mean, firstly, on a moral, shall we say, level, they don't like feeling the outsiders. They don't like that. And, in fact, they get very annoyed at what they feel is Western hypocrisy. But secondly, I think they are becoming aware of the extent to which this is a real political challenge. And if you look at the whole issue of Syria, which I know we're going to be coming on to in the second part, but, I mean, it's clear that they actually are realising that being the pariah,
mm-hmm.
being, shall we say, sort of the next best thing Europe has to precisely a toxic state,
mm-hmm.
is actually a real issue, a real problem, and they're trying to do something about it.
Mm. Well, and that's a good way to segue into the second part. And yes, I am wearing a jacket, anybody that's wondering. And tomorrow, hold on to your hats, folks, as I'll actually be wearing a tie. That doesn't happen very often, but
don't believe it until you see it.
I totally will not have socks as cool as the Union Jack socks that Mark had the gall to wear today on his panel, which were visible to the entire audience when he crossed his legs.
And
I think some photos may have been tweeted about that, so keep an eye on somebody's Twitter feed, not mine. But in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and talk about my panel, which is scheduled for Friday afternoon. It should be going on just as this podcast hits the web. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the special edition of the Power Vertical podcast from the Warsaw Security Forum. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog at RFERL. Joining me here is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Вторая гибридная, так россияне называют появление своих.
Почему Москве удается помочь Ближнему Востоку?
Продолжает дестабилизировать ситуацию на востоке Украины.
Для чего Россия вмешалась в происходящее?
Войны на Донбассе нужен, в Крыму нужен новый.
Но все-таки Украина самый вероятный вариант начала.
Сирия Сирией, но Украину не стоит сбрасывать со счетов.
So on Friday I'm slated to moderate a panel titled "Russia's gamble in Ukraine and Syria: How will it affect European security?" It'll include Russian State Duma Deputy Ilya Ponomarev, as we know, the one vote against the Crimean annexation, a very brave man, now living in the United States here in Warsaw for the Security Forum. It'll also include former Ukrainian Foreign Minister Boris Tarasyuk and NATO's former rep in Moscow, Robert Pshal, who had the toughest job in the world, I believe, among others. I plan to, because when I looked at the title of this, and this is how I have to frame it, the title of the panel assumes there is a connection between the Ukrainian and the Syrian interventions, which leaves the question of how are these things connected? And as I thought of how I'm going to frame this panel, because this is basically my task tomorrow, is to frame it. I came up with the following, Mark. Let's do a little experiment here and let you pretend you're on my panel as the panel's actually going on. We'll kind of do a dry run here. There's three ways to look at this. It's a defensive move by Russia, which is Syria is a defensive move by Russia. They're shoring up their last ally in the Middle East. But if it's also a defensive move, assuming they lost Ukraine, they have to become active elsewhere. And this, the underlying assumption, if you go from this is a defensive move, it's Russia in decline. Right? The second possible model of this is that it's a transactional move. It's a transactional move. Ukraine's in play, and Russia is trying to create a bargaining chip in the Middle East that it can hopefully trade to get its way in Ukraine. This model assumes that Russia is a regional power and nothing more. It's not a global power. It's making trouble in a global hotspot in order to have a bargaining chip in the thing it cares most about, its own backyard, the former Soviet Union, and most importantly, Ukraine. So that's a second way to look at that. The third is that this is aspirational. Putin won Ukraine, and now he's marching on to win in Syria as well. Moving forward, this assumes that Russia is a resurgent power. Let's pretend you're on my panel. Let's pretend I just framed it that way, as I'm going to frame it tomorrow. How would you respond here if I said which of these do you subscribe to, or are they not mutually exclusive?
Well, I think this is it. I, much like Russia, I'm greedy, and I think I'd want to grab two out of the three. Let me put aside the notion of Russia ascendant, even in its own eyes. And we've got to realize that sometimes this is the issue. Actually, the world as it looks from the Kremlin may well be different from our world. But I see no signs at the moment that they feel happy with what's been going on in the Donbass. I think there are fairly clear indications that they realize that they've hit a quagmire, and they're looking for ways of cutting their losses. They don't really think that actually they've got any chance.
Cutting their losses or pursuing their war aims by political means?
Well,
politics is war by other means, right?
That it certainly is. But I think that at the moment, as it were, what's going on in the Donbass is a challenge to their capacity to use political means more than anything else. So I would say it's in some ways it's both of the other two. On the one level, it is absolutely transactional, in my opinion. They are hoping that Syria can somehow be a token that they can trade for something that is actually more important for them. Does this make Russia a regional power? Well, yes, but obviously, like any power that is willing to pay the price, it can also sometimes operate outside of its immediate region. But I think a disproportionate cost, and Syria, I think, is going to prove to be that disproportionate cost. More importantly, though, this is, for me, definitely Russia in decline. Crimea, and that's what's in way, we're back to this human tendency to overcompensation. I think because Crimea went so easily, they overcompensated and they thought, my gosh, well, the rest of Ukraine will be able to tame very easily, and their own momentum carried them into the Donbass. And then they got stuck. And then they realized that actually it wasn't going to be so easy, and no amount of fine-tuning your hybrid warfare techniques is going to turn around when you actually essentially got a regime which is unwilling and unable to bend the knee, and is beginning increasingly to get the assistance and the support and the moral assistance as well to continue to do that. And perhaps most importantly of all, people in Ukraine, that even while they may still be very annoyed with certain aspects of their new regime, they are pretty united in their unwillingness to become basically vassals of Moscow.
Right.
So Ukraine hasn't worked out at all. And so now they're desperately trying to find ways of cutting their costs, because this is not, I would say, a long-term sustainable war. And again, here is one of the fascinating differences between modern Russia and the Soviet Union. It wasn't the 70s, but the 80s. The Soviet Union got into Afghanistan in 79, and it would spend 10 years in this miserable guerrilla war, which was actually much more extensive than the Donbass operation. I mean, on average, they had 100,000 people in Afghanistan at any one time. 1 million Soviet citizens went through that war. But nonetheless, the Soviets could actually bear that cost. It did not bring down the system. It didn't bring down the economy. They could have continued until it was just simply that Gorbachev decided that there was a much greater political value in being the guy who brings the boys home and thus kickstarting a new detente, rather than because they had no options. The Russians now, the Russians, I don't think, could absorb the costs of staying in Donbass at the current level for another 2 years, let alone another nine. This is actually something that is really taxing them politically, taxing them economically, and therefore they are having to pull out. If you can't even...
I mean, oil prices were still high until...
Yeah, those are the good days. And oil prices were high, political control was still extreme. You know, I mean, for all these kind of reasons, the Soviets were in a very different position. Now, the day when Moscow can't even basically occupy a chunk of Ukraine and not be able to feel the cost. I mean, and that really says something about just how scaled down Russia is compared to the Soviet Union.
So that said, and another question that's going to come up on the panel is, how should the West respond to this dual challenge of Ukraine and Syria? And what would you say to that? Because there will be policymakers that will be...
Sure. Well, I mean, I think in a way, the issue is you've got to decide what's most important. And the trouble is here, there is clearly, in my opinion, a division between the United States and Europe. Europe thinks that what's most important is to bring peace to Ukraine. And then you sort out the rest afterwards. But peace is the first sort of precondition. And if that means basically, under the right circumstances, giving the Russians an easy out.
Right.
Not after, you know, Crimea is off the table. I mean, there's no way that as long as Putin...
Although nobody could say that.
Well, no, nobody can say that, but I think everyone realises that so long as Putin is in the Kremlin, the Crimea is off the table. And therefore, certain sanctions will have to remain. There cannot be a return to year zero.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, one could make quite a few steps towards renormalisation. So I think that is the European position, and therefore I think in some ways we let Putin buy himself out of a bad move. That is the European position, and if that's what you want, if peace is important. The other perspective is actually maybe the issue is basically punishing Putin and making a point about the importance of international law, making a point about the parameters within which leaders and societies can operate, which I think is, I won't necessarily say is administration policy, but it's certainly much more heavily espoused
in
various circles in Washington. And if that is the case, well, actually then you need to make him bleed.
Well, it would also be espoused here in Poland and in the Baltic states.
Sure, absolutely. But, I mean, and without in any way sort of trying to undermine the dignity of our very gracious hosts here, you know, European Union policy is not made in Poland or the Baltic states. Whatever. But so, I mean, if instead you want to actually make Putin bleed, actually teach a lesson, then you have an even more complex art, because you know you don't want to make Ukraine bleed either.
Right.
Then it's actually we'll be trying to sort of hit that right calibration of what will actually force the Russians out of the Donbass, but on the other hand, without making it too easy for him. But there's going to be a price for that, and that means not just in Syria, but probably elsewhere. You know, maybe with Russia's relations with Iran and so forth, and certainly what's going on in Afghanistan. Russia will not go down easily in this respect.
Will they continue to do this, what you've called geopolitical extortion elsewhere?
If the circumstances arise, I mean, in my opinion, there are no obvious cases like Syria around where a relatively small deployment of force can make a big impact. Mm-hmm. You're actually talking about more sort of subtle, longer-term things, such as, for example, reversing policy and more or less encouraging Iran to assert itself within the Middle East, things like that, which you know will take time and involve a certain loss of control over the region. But yes, I mean, if Russia wants to, it can't prevent the West from doing whatever it wants, but it can certainly extract a price.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think then?
What I do think unequivocally is that Ukraine is of vital importance right now. I do think that Ukraine today is as important that we get Ukraine right and you get Ukraine embedded in the West today as it was that we got West Germany right and got West Germany embedded in the West in after the Second World War. In many ways, it's 1947 in a lot of ways. And I hope that Pete, it's something I've been harping on endlessly, that this is something we got to get right. And that it's not a sideshow, it's center stage. I think Ukraine is no less important to security issues than Syria is, and it shouldn't be a bargaining chip in any of this. Let's play this out now, though, because the Syria-Ukraine thing is almost like a metaphor for what we were talking about, the global issues we were talking about in the first half. How do you see this playing out in the long run? I mean, I tend to think that we're going to be all right. We've been through this before. The West has been through its periods of self-doubt. Every time it goes through these periods of self-doubt, it comes back stronger. Every time Russia overplays its hand, as it always does, it makes itself weaker. And so I actually am, in the very long term, I'm optimistic, both in the microcosm of the Ukraine, Syria, Russia nexus we were just discussing, and in the more macro kind of longer arc of history. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, I definitely on the panel, I was clearly the outlier as the optimist, talking about sort of the prospects for sort of the liberal order. And the interesting thing is, I mean, because I'm an optimist on two levels. One is actually precisely, I think that this is just simply the crisis of realignment, the metamorphosis from which a sort of a new iteration of the liberal order will emerge. But also, as you know, I'm actually more optimistic about Russia.
Mm-hmm. Than I am. Exactly. Which is a role reversal from a couple of years ago.
is a sort of, I think, you know, the potentialities for actually Russia to reform itself. Again, I'm not saying next year, but sort of certainly within my lifetime. But the interesting point is that when one looks at, okay, so what do we do about it? We can't just simply sit back and say, oh, time's going to be on our side. Let's sort of assume that everything will be fine. We have to be doing things here and now. And here, my big concern is exactly about the West's willingness and its capacity to pay the costs for any substantive action. And we saw this in the Middle East. That too often we want to have results that are quick and easy and at arm's length. You know, Libya was a classic case in point. Surely we can just basically bomb and cruise missile this country into an order that we'd like, and by gosh, it didn't. And likewise, I think with Ukraine, on the one hand, there is clearly, and understandably and rightly, in my opinion, a disinclination to actually send combat troops. I mean, I think the point when that might have been useful, I think, has gone.
And I'm not sure we need that. Right?
No, exactly. Not now. But there, you know, there were points where actually sort of the balance of power looked rather different. We're very worried about, oh, well, won't the Russians have escalation dominance? If we send weapons, the Russians will send more weapons. Well, that's fine. We can still outspend them. We can still out.
But you're opposed to sending weapons.
Well, I don't think it's useful. But that's not the same as, I mean, I think there are, what I'm more worried about, there are other people who think that weapons would be useful, but don't, because they're worried about what the Russians are doing. I'm just doing it because actually I think we're at the stage where the Ukrainians have got enough weaponry. Thank you very much. That's the battle now is to be fought on governance. And then when we come to governance, I mean, if you look at what happened to West Germany, that was an astonishing success story for the liberal order, for democracy and so forth, and really a half...
It's the gold standard.
But when you say gold standard, I mean, you know, it cost a lot of gold in the process, but it also actually required more or less the... for a while, the submersion of West German sovereignty. I mean, essentially, this was something that was done to...
And are the Ukrainians ready for that? Would they?
And I think that is the problem. And
well, this is something I want to raise in tomorrow's panel, since I have the former Ukrainian foreign minister on it.
It's not, I think, for a minute that we would actually expect or want Kiev to say, let us become a protectorate. Please send your colonial...
Well, no, I mean, there's different levels of limited sovereignty.
Sovereignty. I think this is, it's actually much more... Also, how far are the Ukrainians truly, or enough Ukrainians, truly willing to be partners? Partners in this process. I mean, because what we see is, yes, that there is a vibrant grassroots civil society. There are clearly people at the heart of power who really do want to bring about change. And there are also clearly people for whom change is something that as long as it only enriches them. And let's be honest, it starts from the top. When you have a president who said before he was elected that he would basically put all his assets in trust, and now, well, actually, no, I don't think I'll do that, and his assets have increased by 20%, that immediately sets a certain message. So I think it's that how far are the Ukrainians really willing to let us work with them? We can't just simply give them good governance in a box.
No.
It's for them to actually learn it.
All right, well, on that note, I guess we can wrap it up. It's a little bit shorter than usual this week, but it's unusual circumstances this week. I'd like to remind you have been listening to a special edition of the Power Vertical podcast from the Warsaw Security Forum. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russian security issues, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the enlightening discussion, as always, Mark.
Yeah, it's fun to do it face-to-face.
It is always fun to do it face-to-face, and it's fun to do Summit in Warsaw. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer Tanya Kancheva, who will have the joy of post-producing this masterpiece, and my indispensable colleague Pavel Butorin, senior producer at RFARL's Russian language television program Current Time, who is now tweeting under the handle at Pasha Butorin, and his feed is as awesome as ever. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog at rfarl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.